case number 86229 in the matter of the guardianship of CAC, AMC, and CAC protected minors. Everybody ready to proceed? Counsel, so like the prior arguments, this matter is also set for 30 minutes total, 15 minutes per side. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I'll be reserving 2 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Okay, and as you heard me tell the others before you, so when the clock ticks down from 15 minutes and gets to 2 minutes then, you will get the yellow light and a tone, but the clock does keep running until it gets to zero. Go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honor, and members of the court. My name is Melvin Grimes. I am counsel for the appellant in this case. Also with me today is Lynn Hughes. We want to inform the court I'm here to argue the 14th Amendment section of this, which I believe is the major issue. But if there's fact specific, I will simply step back. Lynn will step forward and address those issues with the court, with the court's indulgence. Your Honor, we are asking today, I've done many appeals, but this is the first time I've appeared before all seven of you, and there's a few nerves at the moment. We are asking this court to set aside the substantial enhancement clause of the minor guardianship statute. The rights of parentage have long been recognized as a civil liberty in this country, ever since Skinner v. Oklahoma, Prince v. Massachusetts. The problem with this termination statute is it violates 14th Amendment requirements, both for equal protection and equal treatment of equally positioned people in the termination, and that it's not narrowly tailored to the what the state needs to accomplish. No one is arguing that guardianship is wrong. Guardianship is necessary to meet a public requirement. The issue is when a parent returns to suitability and they reach a point where they are ready to return the children to them, the current standard is so onerous and so unmeetable that it doesn't occur. I have done these cases, Mr. Hughes has done these cases, where the substantial enhancement standard is required.
So, Mr. Grimes, are you making a facial and as-applied challenge here?
Yes.
And then with the equal protection, what two groups are you comparing in terms of that analysis?
So the termination statute creates two groups, those who affirmatively acknowledge that a guardianship is necessary and consent. And then the second group is those who either don't consent and take it to an evidentiary hearing or tacitly acknowledge, meaning they don't show up. Either of those groups are placed in a position where they must meet the substantial enhancement burden, and it cannot be met.
Is that an issue really with the statute or with how the district court treats the idea of what non-apparent should mean?
I think the court could address that, but even if they don't agree, it's still a statutory issue because substantial enhancement is never defined anywhere. It is my belief that the intent was to encourage parents to use the guardianship statute to fix their issues in their life. I don't think there's any issue there. The problem is they didn't define what that means. There is no way for them to meet that burden. If you look at a 432B case, which often has a guardianship in there as well, they include the case plan. They have a clear roadmap. Here, they don't.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, I just want to understand. Are you arguing the substantial enhancement standard is always unconstitutional, or are you saying it's unconstitutional as to someone like your client's situation where because of her failure to appear, there wasn't a full hearing back when the guardianship was established?
My argument before the court today on the 14th Amendment issue, Your Honor, is that it is always unconstitutional because it's not defined. Okay? The 14th Amendment requires that when we infringe upon a civil liberty, that the orders must be narrowly tailored. substantially enhanced without a definition is not narrowly tailored.
But we've got, in so many aspects of our law, there's no definitions. When you're talking about best interests of a child, there are certain things that you consider, but there's so many number of other areas that aren't specifically defined. Why can't a district court make these determinations?
Well, the court could, but the problem is there is no definition, so no one ever meets the substantial enhancement. If you go to best interest, that's in the custody statute.
Correct. Yeah.
And custody's right. been addressed by the Supreme Court.
Right.
And in Reno v. Flores, the court even said best interest is often used in custody.
Right. And I don't want to cabinet to best interest. That's just
okay.
I'm saying there's a number of areas that aren't defined.
Well, and yet they end up before this court and other courts of appellate jurisdiction where you are faced with, well, and again, I was here for this morning. If all of a sudden we're bringing in a gun right one, there's no question that's a civil liberty, and any order must be narrowly tailored. As I recall, and that's not my area of practice, we did narrowly tailor stuff in only saying bump stocks weren't going to be allowed. Well, that's what we need here. If the court doesn't want to simply strike, and that's what I believe should occur, we don't change the clear and convincing evidence requirement. They have to show that they return to suitability. The problem is the second. It's punitive, and it doesn't allow a parent to return to suitability and to have their children returned.
Is it punitive or protective of the child? Because we do have to balance both interests, right? I mean, there is a constitutional, we've already held, there's a constitutional right in raising your own children and a fundamental liberty interest there, but that, there's also a right for a child to be in a safe environment that's secure. And so I think that's where that two-part analysis came from in 159. And if you consent to it, you're kind of saying, I am unfit. So that prong has been met. If you say I don't consent to it, we've never gone through that analysis. So as applied to your client, I think I can get there. But facially, I'm not sure that I'm quite there with you in terms of
And I would caution the court here to be very careful. Guardianship is not custody. And the two should not be confused. Fitness is not a question in guardianship. It's suitability, and it's defined by statute. It's in the very statute that we're talking about. Suitability is providing housing, clothing, education, health care. That's suitability, and that meets the requirement that was laid out by the Supreme Court. The problem is, often, because we're all in family court, and we're family court practitioners, we conflate the two. We put them together, and we're worried about protecting the child. There's other avenues for that. 432B looks at fitness. 432B looks at best interest. Guardianship doesn't.
How would you define substantially enhanced, though? I mean, to for this statute in your mind to be appropriate, you're saying it doesn't define substantially enhanced. The thought that comes to mind is all the jurors for 20 years that would laugh when we would define reasonable doubt as one based on reason, right? Preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not. Substantially enhanced substantially. I mean, what more specificity would there be for that terminology?
The best analogy for that is the way guardianship is used in 432B cases. There is a very concise roadmap given to the parent to return to parentage. You must do the following, okay? So, yes, you got to show you've returned to fitness, but because of your issues, and let's take this one. She had a drug issue.
Right.
If the roadmap is complete drug treatment, stay clean and sober for 12 consecutive months, whatever it was, there should have been a roadmap that allowed her to return there. But right now, it's not defined. Now, this court does have the option to simply say, we're going to define it as this, and this is what courts will do. But I will say that if you look at the statute, it's not necessary. Simply striking this puts everybody on equal footing. Clear and convincing is still an elevated standard of proof to show, and that's what the standard is. It's not preponderance of evidence.
But Sorry. Aren't you still going to have the same procedural problem? You had an adjudication that the guardianship was appropriate to impose, and it either arrives at that adjudication by consent, by a determination after a contested evidence hearing where the person didn't consent and it was litigated and they lost or won, or a situation where they were served with the proceedings, said they were coming, didn't show up, so there's a default, in essence, default judgment on that. So the issue of underlying that is the question of what preclusion, if any, do you attach to that when they come back later and want to have the guardianship restored. If you don't have the statute, you're still going to have the same problem.
But again, I see two questions here, so I'm going to address both of them. The first one is, this creates people who are on equal footing to be treated differently within the court, which is a direct violation of the 14th Amendment. Okay? That's the problem with the substantial enhancement clause.
Who are the equal people again?
When they appear on this is a petition to terminate, not a petition for guardianship, so you have to think at the end. When these parents arrive, they arrive as unsuitable parents. They're standing before the court as unsuitable. Right. They have to prove that they are suitable again. So they are on equal footing, and they should be treated the same. So that's where I believe that...
The same as who?
As the parent who acknowledged unsuitability and consented to the guardianship, or those who did not, or, as the Justice pointed out, created a default.
Because the idea of the guardianship in the first instance is, if you consent to the guardianship, the idea is that you've recognized the best interests of my children are going to be served by a guardian being put in place because I'm incapable of doing that right now, versus somebody that's not arguably acting in the best interest of their kids by objecting to the guardianship and saying, I don't have any problems, I don't need anybody else's help, I don't want a guardian. So when they come to the court later on, they bring that, call it whatever you will, baggage or history with them, so they're not really on equal footing when they come in there.
I understand the court's concern, and I get that. But the court will not be surprised that we have more than one case. We pick the one to appeal, okay? There is a case currently pending. We're waiting for this decision for various reasons. But he didn't consent. He didn't consent because he was in ICU. And the court has determined that he is held to the higher standard because he didn't consent. He was unavailable and created a default. And
that goes back to my earlier question about how should the district court be treating a non-appearance, for instance. Mm-hmm. Like, let's talk about local district court rules. You don't oppose a motion, you're deemed to have consented to the granting of it. Should a non-appearance be a consent? When earlier you objected, should a non-appearance be an admission that I need a guardian in place? I mean, it seems to me that's a bigger issue than whether the statute is constitutional or not.
I think both are equal. Again, we all have our different views on things, and I've known several of you for years, and so I hold you in great esteem, but I honestly think the plain language of the statute, adding that additional burden to a select group, one, and again, if you look at the entirety of the minors guardianship statute, there's already a vexatious litigant. So refiling to terminate it doesn't really serve a purpose except to punish those who say, I don't see that I have a problem.
So are you saying that the distinction, like you shouldn't be penalized for litigating the issue of, like, you shouldn't be penalized for opposing a guardianship petition? Are you saying that distinction is what's invalid?
Yes.
Okay, so that is the...
I believe it is flat out unconstitutional.
You say, I'm going to be penalized for litigating this and losing, where the next guy, just because he says, okay, fine, he gets a lighter load later.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay.
And I take great issue with that. But with what Justice Herndon is raising, I think the court also has that option. Define substantial enhancement or direct the district courts to create a roadmap to substantial enhancement and define that. Either, I think, could meet the constitutional requirement. Personally, I still take great issue with creating two groups of people and treating them different in the termination. I think ultimately that does create a constitutional issue. But can it be addressed through that and protect the child that way? Yes, but again, I think we have to look then at the 432Bs. But in these cases, and they're rare. They are rare. they act as a termination of parental rights. The guardian has the right to withhold visitation. The guardian has the right to not involve the parents at all. And that you're missing the very protection that this court set out in calling a TPR a civil death penalty. And it needs to be treated with that level of scrutiny. And yet, here we are. We're
counsel. I know we're.
I know I'm
low
watching
on time, but I got to ask this though.
Okay.
The court entered its minute order in November of 2021, and there was not an actual order and judgment filed until February 28, 2023. These yes. children are aging, and now it's 2024, and they've been in guardianship since 2016. Like, so I guess the short question is, why did it take so long to get an order?
That
you may
was,
answer.
Lynn Hughes, I was trial counsel, and that was a frustrating part. And I don't have a proper explanation. It got so frustrating that that's when I issued or prepared the order that is the order of the
court. Were you trying to get the other parties to submit the order as the court asked them to during
so
that time?
Emails were sent. They were not responded to. I am not sure they were actually received, whether they went to spam or somewhere else. And I didn't make a phone call, so I fell short on that part. But at some point, I issued this order. Counsel signed off on it. It was signed off by the judge, and I appealed immediately. So I don't have a better answer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There was a lot of questions. I'll give 2 minutes for rebuttal, and I'll give an extra 2 minutes to respondents.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. I'm Raina Dahlia Hunt. I am appearing on behalf of the protected minors in this matter, and I'll ask for 11 minutes and reserve 12 minutes and reserve 5 for
okay.
The other respondents' counsel.
Got it.
This case is about three young children. As Your Honor noted, these children have not only been under guardianship since 2016, they've actually lived with their grandparents their entire lives. The oldest will turn 14 in June. It's almost three quarters of a childhood. We believe on the plain language of the statute, the outcome here is clear. What the appellant is very blatantly asking this court to do is either strike down wholesale a 7-year-old statute that this court has had the occasion to evaluate before, or failing that, rewrite the statute and I guess now add language into the statute that's not currently present.
Well, counsel, how would you define substantially enhanced?
I think Justice Herndon kind of noted it is a self-defining term. Substantially enhanced makes significantly better. I don't have the years of experience that the other attorneys on this matter have, though I do exclusively practice in the area of minor guardianship. Guardianships are terminated. Non-consensual guardianships are terminated. It is relatively rare. Some guardianships last from ages 0 to 18, and some last for a year or so. And what we see anecdotally is cases where a guardian has declined, and the child would be better suited living with their parent. The child has had the opportunity to develop a strong relationship with their parent with the additional protection of the guardianship, and they are asking to return to their parent's care, or all parties have agreed that that is significantly in their best interest to have the opportunity to live with a parent, because, of course, there is a presumption that a child is best suited living with a fit parent.
In order to terminate the guardianship, don't they would already have to show as a parent that they're returned to suitability? And I want to confirm with you that they would also have to show that the termination would be in the best interest of the child.
Correct.
So why isn't that enough it's not only in their best interest that it would be substantially enhanced. Like, why should that be an extra part of the analysis?
So I think the reason why when a guardianship is not consented to and it's essentially forced without either no participation from the parent or over their objection, the recognition of a parent that a guardianship is necessary is acting in a child's best interest. It's a recognition, in this case, for example, I'm struggling with substance abuse, I need help, I can't care for my children. But when the guardianship is forced, that's a recognition that the parent is not acting in their child's best interest.
What about in this instance where the mom wanted to contest it, and she didn't show up for the calendar call, not the evidentiary hearing itself, but the calendar call. And as a function of that, the court vacates the evidentiary hearing and grants a guardianship, a permanent guardianship with all three. I know the one was consented to before, but, you know, does that really meet the due process requirements to, with an opportunity to be heard? Because if you have to make this factual determination, how can you do that without an evidentiary hearing?
I think it does meet the procedural due process requirements to protect mom's parental rights. She was served with the notice. She obviously objected. She did have the opportunity to present evidence, including at an evidentiary hearing. She just chose not to appear. What guardianship courts do not do, and perhaps what they should do, is guardianship courts generally do not do a prove-up, where if a parent does not appear to object to a guardianship, they generally do not swear in the petitioner and under oath have them present evidence why guardianship is necessary. That may be a better practice, but there was substantial evidence presented at the initial citation hearing that a guardianship was necessary. In fact, there was such sufficient evidence that the district court took it upon itself to order only supervised visitation between mom and the children at that point. So there was already a recognition at the citation hearing that there were issues going on. Mom also did testify at the evidentiary hearing on the petition to terminate that she was not in the position at that time to care for her children, that she was, as I understand it, so intoxicated she really couldn't understand the proceedings.
She does have one child in her custody, correct?
Yes, that is correct. She has an afterborn child who was removed at birth because they were born substance exposed to methamphetamine, and that child was also placed with the grandparents, and she ultimately worked a case plan and had that child reunify with her. She did not at that time seek to terminate the guardianship. I believe she waited an additional 2 years to seek to terminate this guardianship.
So if we're trying to protect kids, why does it matter how the guardianship started? Why aren't we just looking at what's going on with the kids at the time that there's a request to terminate the guardianship? Because just because somebody recognizes that a guardianship is appropriate doesn't necessarily mean they're making a good decision when they make the request for the guardianship. The parent making the request to terminate the guardianship doesn't necessarily mean that they're in a good place to do that, or they're making that because that's really what's best for the kids at that point in time.
I agree. As with any custody determination, the proper inquiry is really what is in the child's best interest. And this court evaluated those factors numerous times, including in Lachlan and Litz, where it set forth even when a parent is fit, under what circumstances the parental preference could be overcome. And I believe, as argued in the written closing arguments at the district court level, that there was significant evidence presented that the guardianship remaining intact was in the children's best interest. I think that substantial enhancement comes in part because when a guardianship is contested or not consented to, we have an additional interest in the stability of children and in making sure they're not bouncing around between parents who...
But wouldn't that be adequately accounted for in the best interest of a child? Like, you can look at the best interest of a child, which we do when there's a proposed change of custody in a little different context. That's what we look at, material change of circumstances and best interest of a child. And here, we're saying not only is it enough that there was a change of circumstances and the parent's now suitable and that it's in the child's best interest, but even if it's in the child's best interest, we're not going to move them because it's not enough more best interest. That doesn't seem logical.
I think part of what the recognition, the bifurcation of the statute is a recognition that the parent did not initially understand the reason for need for guardianship. They did not consent. In the dependency context that's referred to as the pre-contemplation phase. When you consider substantial enhancement of a child's welfare, we're essentially asking the parent to understand why the guardianship was necessary in the first place. It's asking that parent to get to that thought process that they didn't get to initially.
Well, here, didn't the district court find that, in fact, this parent did get to that point and had substantially improved and was now operating as a full-grown adult and with responsibility, taking care of a child, working regularly, passing drug tests at work? all of those things. So hasn't she shown that here?
So she has shown that she has maintained sobriety. And I would agree the procedural history on this case is not good. I was not the counsel at the district court level. It's not. I'm not happy with how it came to be either. Yeah.
Right. I mean, obviously, that's not good for the children when it takes a year and a half just to get an order in.
Absolutely. And I also wish that the district court had issued actual findings of fact rather than rely. It's honestly.
The district court did. The court signed the order, so that's the court's order.
Correct. Yeah.
Whoever prepared it, the court signed the order. And didn't counsel for the children sign off on it?
She did.
Okay.
But even with the facts as even with the findings of fact as articulated in the order that was signed off on, the facts support that mom did maintain sobriety. And that is one of the suitability factors under NRS 159A.061. The other factor under 061 that's relevant is whether by action or inaction the parent poses a significant risk of physical or emotional harm to the children. There was significant testimony, including by the oldest child at the evidentiary hearing, that he was being routinely physically abused by mom, and as were his siblings. That was absent from the order, unfortunately. But when we're looking at substantial enhancement, that can't possibly include entrance for the first time in their lives of children into a parent's custody who's routinely physically and emotionally abusing them. So even if there is a question on the law relating to substantial enhancement generally, here we have a parent who is missing a key part of safely caring for children, which is not physically harming them when they're in her care.
So, I mean, I guess ultimately the bottom line question that they're raising is substantial enhancement, in addition to the other showings, including best interest, already required, is that too big a burden on the recognized constitutional right to parent your child?
So I think under the substantive due process question, the question is whether or not it's narrowly tailored to accomplish a compelling state interest. I think every party would agree that there's a compelling state interest in preserving the safety of children. So whether or not it's narrowly tailored is really what's at stake here. Here, we have this bifurcated system that came largely from this court's decision in Hudson v. Jones, which directly quoted that when a parent who seeks to modify custody in cases involving a litigated custody dispute and a prior determination of either unfitness or extraordinary circumstances justifying the award of custody to a non-parent is no longer entitled to the parental preference. Right. So here we want parents to consent. We want parents to act in their child's best interest. When they don't, they need to at some point face a higher burden.
But
to
why? Because, I mean, it strikes me that you are penalizing the parent who wants to litigate whether or not a guardianship should be imposed. And under this statute, that then becomes a prelude to eventual sort of de facto termination of parental rights. So I see the larger problem with this statute, that it is problematic to, I mean, there might be some preclusion issue with the original determination, but should you be penalized for going to court and asserting that you are a capable parent entitled to maintain custody and jurisdiction over this kid?
So just addressing one point first, this is not a termination of parental rights.
I understand that, but it's a prelude to those issues, is their argument under this statute, that the cost of objecting, we have a whole consent issue here, but that you're penalized for objecting and litigating and losing. So it increases the risk of objecting.
So the standard for establishing a guardianship at the inception is just as high as the standard for terminating a guardianship down the road. The petitioner has to show by clear and convincing evidence that a guardianship is necessary, and the district court must dismiss the petition if a guardianship is not needed. So
the court didn't actually make that finding here.
Well, it made the finding that a guardianship was necessary by granting the guardianship. Okay. Mom, by her own admission, was not able to care for her children. She was actively abusing methamphetamine at the time. So guardianship over these children was certainly necessary, and the petitioners met their burden there. So if a petitioner can't meet their burden, if a parent is currently suitable, with all of the protections in place for parental rights in Nevada, where the presumption is a child should be with their parent, then yes, if the parent fails to satisfy, if a parent, despite all that, still is unable to care for their child, then yes, there is a penalty, but it's not for every parent. The petitioner still bears the initial burden to prove that a guardianship is necessary. I want to make sure my other respondent has time. So with that, I would ask that the court affirm the district court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
And good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I would like to, I'm Peter James for the guardians, Your Honors. I would like to address some very significant but specific issues. One of those is that the default is really not an issue here today. The remedy for a default would be to set it aside. And there's plenty of case law saying how you can set aside something that was entered by default. Opposing counsel mentioned someone was in the hospital. He's come back and say, I was in the hospital. I didn't have a chance. I want to set it aside. And that's something that I think would be an abuse of discretion to not set aside. So procedurally, I just want to make that clear. Now, a guardianship, and on an analogy here to sole legal custody, it's not a termination of parental rights. The other side argued that it is. It clearly is not. The guardians cannot just shut out the parents. The parents still have parental rights. They still have the right to be at a doctor's appointment. They still have the right to know about it. They have the right to access to information. They have the right to receive records. They have many rights as a parent. And even with sole legal custody, with two parents that are battling over their own child, that's the same way. Sole legal custody is not a termination of rights, the same way a guardianship is not a termination of rights. It's just someone else is caring for your child because you are unsuitable in the case of a guardianship. Just wanted to make that very distinct distinction. We have a problem in this case where the findings of fact were drawn by counsel. And a regular motion hearing, an order, fine. Setting trial dates, minimal findings, things like that. I understand you don't want to burden the courts with that kind of stuff, that it's perfectly fine for the attorneys to draft that. After a trial, that really should be done by the court.
Okay, now, but there's nothing requiring that, counsel, and it happens all the time. And if the court signs it, it's the court's order. Once the court signs it, it's no longer counsel's order, it's the court's order.
You are 100% correct. However, there's been case law issued. In most of the Court of Appeals taking serious issue with the fact that attorneys are drafting findings and the courts are just adopting them. And that's kind of what I'm addressing here. One of them was one of my cases that we had oral argument in front of the Court of Appeals where their main holding was the district court really should have done its own order. And that was a major point they were taking in that. So this is an issue that's floating around. And it became an issue here because there were many...
Was there a dispute about the order when it was submitted by counsel to the court?
I am only appellate counsel. I was not there at the time.
Did anyone ask for reconsideration and say, Judge, did you really mean to make this finding? That wasn't the way you were leaning in court.
Yeah. No, that was not done. And I understand. I just wanted to make the point on that. As far as the standards go and what is best interest, what is substantial change, even in custody, we don't have any law guiding this. May I finish my thought?
Yes, finish your thought.
The only guidance we have in custody is Ellis versus Carucci, which is unexplained bad grades is enough to change from primary to one to primary to the other. But this is where you go to judicial discretion because you can't define every single set of circumstances that can happen to a family. It's just impossible. That's why you have vague terms like substantially enhanced and best interest and substantial change. I'm happy to answer any further questions the court may have.
Nope, I think we're good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
All right, 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Lynn Hughes again for the appellant. And I just want to define, my two real issues are, what is substantially enhanced because I can't find a definition for that. And in my brief, how do you explain to a judge what substantially enhanced is? When, in this case, when an individual is a drug addict recovering, they are in a hole they've got to dig out of to start with, and then they have to somehow substantially enhance the life of their children to get them back. That is a burden that cannot be met.
You know, aren't there just factors that you can present to the court saying, okay, this is what I'm showing you to show the child's life will be substantially enhanced, just but like material changes.
They are factors, but nobody defines what those factors are. Does it require that they have to have enough money to put them in?
Change of circumstances. You show things, and the judge will make a determination.
So the significant change of circumstances is in the statute prior to that. They have to show a significant change of circumstances and be restored to suitability, and then somehow meet the substantial enhancement standard, which is just a cloud that they have to meet.
You don't dispute they have to show best interest as well, do you?
No, that's the statute for custody. All those factors.
I mean, to terminate the guardianship.
Yes.
To show termination would be in the best interest of the child.
Yes, I believe so. But the other part of this is the consent side of it, which I find to be such a struggle. In the case law before the statute, Litz versus Benham and Lachlan versus Duca and everything else, when the substantial enhancement language was there, you had to be found to be unfit. It wasn't something where you came in and consented. You had to be found to be unfit before that language became the burden you had to meet. And so if a parent came in or did not come in, if they didn't show up, that was deemed to be acquiescence. The guardianship was granted. And as long as they met suitability when they came back, the guardianship was terminated.
Thank you.
I can go on and on. Sorry. Thank you.
All right. Counsel, thank you for briefing your briefing in this case and your arguments today. This matter will